people can have really complex pelvic disease and no pain at all. People can have really minimal amount of superficial endometriosis and lots of pain, and then everywhere in between. So the amount of endometriosis does not correlate to the amount of symptoms a patient has. And I think that's really important because people will go online and a lot of people in the endometriosis community talk to each other and have support groups, which I think is fantastic. But looking at your stage does not identify whether or not you're more affected by endometriosis than another person. And it really breaks my heart when sometimes when people are like, oh, I have all this pain, but I'm only stage one. And I'm like, I don't care if you're only stage one, you have all that pain. And that's what we're talking about today. Or I'm only stage two, but I have infertility. I'm like, I don't care that you're only stage two. We're trying to get you pregnant, right? We're trying to meet your goals. And the stage isn't necessarily going to tell us whether or not you're more or less affected.
And I just want to clarify, when you said I don't care what stage you are, I want to clarify that what you really mean is that it's not relevant to that patient's condition. But I know that you care very much.
It's not that I don't care about the complexity of the disease or how it affects the patient. It's the number of the stage, for me, has very little relevance. Because when we break it down, and I break it down with my patients, I'm like, this is where your lesions are. Right? We identified these lesions on ultrasound. This is what we're going to be doing in terms of surgery. This is how it affects your risk of this and of that. And that's really how we tailor it. And it's so much more personalized.
Hi, superhumans. I'm Dr. Mavis Garcia.
And I'm Dr. Wise.
We're two of the physician leaders at Marken Fertility Center, otherwise known as our baby, MFC.
As fertility specialists, we've witnessed firsthand the challenges, triumphs, and the myriad of emotions that come with trying to conceive. Whether you're just starting to think about having a baby, actively trying, or facing challenges along the way, My Fertility Podcast will be your go-to resource for honest conversations and a supportive community.
So grab a cup of coffee or tea and settle in, and let's demystify the world of fertility together.
We are very excited and privileged to have Dr. Jeff Zenny joining us today. He is a minimally invasive gynecologic surgeon currently practicing at Markham Stouffville Hospital with a particular interest in fertility sparing surgery. And that is something that obviously we love very much. He did his undergrad degree at University of Western Ontario and then did medical school in Australia and then obstetrics and gynecology residency at U of T, where, of course, he met me, which I know is a very pivotal moment in his biography.
I am sure.
Yeah. I've had the privilege of knowing Dr. Zenny for, I looked it up, 8 years, actually. Well, you were just a baby resident, and he has progressed and done incredible things. So he did a surgical fellowship in advanced gynecologic surgery at McMaster. And right now he's doing really, really complex gynecologic surgeries involving endometriosis, fibroids, and mullerian anomalies. He also has a particular interest in advanced gynecologic ultrasound, including endometriosis mapping, fibroid mapping, and the evaluation of mullerian anomalies. Outside of that, he also has interest in surgical education and the advancement of fertility-specific endometriosis research. My favorite piece of information I did not know about him that I learned is that he has one Rate My MD review that went as far to say as he is, quote, cool, brilliant, and a skilled doctor. Now, did you write that one yourself, Dr. Zenny?
Oh, no, I paid my wife to do it.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us. And we are so excited to be able to ask you all of our endo-related questions today.
Thank you guys so much for having me. This is my very first podcast, so I'm a newbie, so go easy on me. I'm not going to lie, a little nervous about this today, but you guys are easing me in, so I'm feeling good. Just to clarify, it was a life-changing moment when I met you, Marta. You know, changed the whole world. I had the pleasure of meeting Mavis after I came to Markham Stouffville, which has been also absolutely incredible. I'm going to just go out on a limb and say I was maybe a little more mature when I met Mavis as opposed to when I met Marta. So that's a nice improvement.
Cool to think, right? Like 8 years, did you think that we would be doing a podcast together?
I figured you'd be doing a podcast. I don't know if I thought I'd ever be an invite, but yeah.
I just want to echo what Dr. Wise said. We are really happy to have you here. You have such an amazing way with patients, and your skills in surgery and your ability to do endometriosis mapping has been a real game changing for many of my patients. So Thank you, Dr. Zanny, for the work that you do for the endometriosis community.
It's my absolute pleasure. I wouldn't do it if it wasn't my passion. I get to do exactly what I love every day. It's great. And the patient population is one that I care so much about. And it means so much to me that you guys actually trust me with your patients in terms of taking care of your patients to their surgical journey as a component of their fertility treatment.
We have lots of questions for you today. Why don't we start by talking about a basic question, like what is endometriosis from your perspective? And specifically, I would like to hear you say a little bit more about these definitions that we hear about all the time and that patients see in Google or on Instagram, like, for example, silent endometriosis, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4 endometriosis, deep infiltrating endometriosis. Can you clarify what is endometriosis and all of these different categories that people talk about?
So I expect a bunch of your listeners are probably going to have a good basic idea of what endometriosis is. But if anybody's out there and they've never heard it, this is a new word for them. We'll kind of start off with that and then we'll move up from there. Endometriosis is a medical condition that affects approximately 10% of people who are born with a uterus. That's a humongous number of women and people who don't necessarily identify as a woman, but also have a uterus. It is a chronic inflammatory condition that has a really, really diverse presentation. And some patients will present with horrible pain. Some patients will present with no symptoms whatsoever, regardless of the complexity of the disease that they have. At its kind of most basic form, endometriosis is cells that are similar to the endometrium, which is the lining of the inside of the uterus, which you shed every month through period, where an embryo implants into to allow for proper implantation and pregnancy. But these cells are really, really similar, not identical, but located somewhere outside of the uterus. So most commonly, we're going to see this inside the pelvis, although there are case reports of this being located in many, many other places, including every different organ of the body, from the brain to the lungs to the chest cavity to the diaphragms, even recently identified in the spleens. It can be located in a whole bunch of different areas. Obviously, the presentation, depending on where it's located, is going to be very different. I think for the purpose of today, we're going to pretty much exclusively talk about pelvic endometriosis, which is by far the most common, and it has a couple of different forms. Endometriosis has what we classify as three main pelvic forms. We start off with the most superficial, which we call superficial endometriosis, which if you can imagine, the entire inside of the abdomen is wrapped in peritoneum, which is a fancy word for like a cellophane wrap for the inside of the abdomen. It's this really, really thin layer that wraps over all of the different organs as well as the walls of the abdomen. And a lot of the time we see these superficial deposits on those surfaces. That includes surfaces overlying the bladder, overlying the rectum, kind of the fat that covers the vasculature for the rectum, as well as the sidewalls of the pelvis, the fallopian tubes, and then the different ligaments that we see inside the pelvis, including sometimes on top of the uterus and on top of the ovaries as well. And these lesions are specific because they're very thin, right? They don't actually deeply invade into any of the tissues that they're on top of. They're just kind of there on the top. And this is the most common form that we see. The second type is what we call deeply invasive endometriosis, which now we just call deep endometriosis. It used to be called DIE, which is a very ominous sounding thing, and people call it DIE. And that is essentially these same cells, but it's a different way that they present, and they form like nodules that actually invade deeply into some of the structures most commonly in the pelvis. So we see this a lot of the time in the ligaments that support the back of the cervix called the uterosacral ligaments, but they can be located in other spots as well. And then finally, what we call ovarian endometriosis, which is kind of those classic endometriomas or chocolate cysts that we see inside the ovaries, which are filled with old blood that over time gets partially digested and looks like molten lint chocolate when we open those cysts inside the OR. That's where it got its chocolate cyst name. And those are commonly talked about, especially in the fertility world, because they have impact in terms of how we manage them with regards to ovarian reserves, and people talk about egg quality as well. I think we'll probably get into that a little bit later. But these form cysts, and those cysts can be small and those cysts can be big. And most commonly, those cysts are actually attached to an area of deep endometriosis. And this is kind of a new finding that we're seeing, those ovaries get stuck to those deep endometriosis nodules. My personal opinion and philosophy is that the endometriosis within the ovary is actually probably born from the deep endometriosis nodule, gets enveloped by the ovary, and then as it bleeds with every cycle, you end up getting these larger and larger cysts. In general, those are the three main pelvic subtypes that we see, and they can have a hugely different kind of way they present with patients. People always want to talk about stage. A lot of my patients are like, okay, well, what stage am I? And this is referring to the ASRM, which is old, well, now old, if we're looking at kind of like modern times, staging system for endometriosis. I don't really care about the stage, to be completely honest. I care about the very specifics in terms of where these lesions are located, because the stage is of 1 through 4, and it's very broad. Somebody can have stage 4 and is not really going to be affecting their fertility as much as somebody who has stage 2 or stage 3 and can have much more of an effect on their fertility, depending on how their tubes are involved or how their ovaries are involved. So it's much more important to actually look at what specific components of endometriosis are involved. A lot of these lesions, especially the deep lesions, cause scarring and adhesions inside the pelvis. So things get stuck together. This becomes problematic when, you know, adhesions involve the fallopian tubes, because the fallopian tubes can be blocked and then you can get a buildup of fluid inside the tubes and the tubes essentially don't work. And that tube that's full of fluid or full of blood can actually prevent pregnancy either through IVF or through natural means, even if the other tube is open and they get pregnant from an embryo that comes from the other ovary through the other tube, ends up in the uterus. But that fluid that's inside the dilated tube actually washes back into the uterus and has toxic effects on the embryo and can theoretically wash the embryo out. So it decreases, you know, our implantation rates. And that's the best evidence kind of we have in terms of the fertility world with endometriosis in terms of treatment. So there's all these different ways that it presents. And that's in terms of how it looks and how it affects fertility, but also big difference in terms of how it presents with regards to pain. Pain is the most common reason I'm seeing patients for endometriosis. Fertility is the second most common, but a lot of the time the investigations start because people have pain and kind of gets somebody's ear up. They have painful periods more than just using Advil for their cramps. And as a result of that, we think maybe there's something else going on here. This sounds like you could potentially have endometriosis. They start to get investigated, and that's kind of when they come to me. People can have really complex pelvic disease and no pain at all. People can have really minimal amount of superficial endometriosis and lots of pain, and then everywhere in between. So the amount of endometriosis does not correlate to the amount of symptoms a patient has. And I think that's really important because people will go online and a lot of people in the endometriosis community talk to each other and have support groups, which I think is fantastic. But looking at your stage does not identify whether or not you're more affected by endometriosis than another person. And it really breaks my heart when sometimes when people are like, oh, I have all this pain, but I'm only stage 1. And I'm like, I don't care if you're only stage 1, you have all that pain. And that's what we're talking about today. Or I'm only stage 2, but I have infertility. I'm like, I don't care that you're only stage 2. We're trying to get you pregnant, right? We're trying to meet your goals. And the stage isn't necessarily going to tell us whether or not you're more or less affected. That kind of answers some of these questions.
Yeah, that's great. And I just want to clarify, when you said I don't care what stage you are, I want to clarify that what you really mean is that it's not relevant to that patient's condition. I know that you care very much.
It's not that I don't care about the complexity of the disease or how it affects the patient. It's the number of the stage for me has very little relevance. Yeah. Because when we break it down and I break it down with my patients, I'm like, this is where your lesions are, right? We identified these lesions on ultrasound. This is what we're going to be doing in terms of surgery. This is how it affects your risk of this and of that. And that's really how we tailor it. And it's so much more personalized. I think the 1 to 4 scale is too general. And it takes something that's so complex and tries to put it into a really kind of regimented boxes. And that people don't fit into those big, broad boxes.
Thank you for that excellent explanation, endometriosis. So the big question is, how do you make the diagnosis? What are ways that you can sort of get a sense of who has endo and what's going on if it's affecting that many patients?
I think there's two answers. There's a answer I would teach my medical students and residents and how they have to answer their examination questions. And there's the realistic what we see in the clinic. The exam answer for this is you start with your history, you talk about people's symptoms, fertility, pain, then you move on to your physical examination. Sometimes we can feel nodules in the, behind the cervix on examination. And then we move to investigations with ultrasound or MRI, and then, you know, potentially diagnosis through laparoscopy or surgery. Now, in reality, that's not usually how this works. So people get referred to me when there's already a suspicion of endometriosis. So a lot of that legwork has already started to be done. Sometimes they've already had surgery with a diagnosis, either a visual diagnosis or a pathologic diagnosis. That diagnosis doesn't necessarily tell us how complex the disease is, and almost never does that operative note give us all of the information we're going to want, which is funny because sometimes we get so much more information from an ultrasound than we do from an operative note, which seems backward in the old school way of thinking. But realistically, in the clinic, I have a patient who's sent to me. Sometimes that diagnosis is made on ultrasound beforehand. They have endometriomas that are visualized on an ultrasound because they have a very classic appearance, or they have a previous surgery with a diagnosis, or they have a presumed diagnosis based off clinical features. And then we talk about all of their symptoms and what their goals are. We do a physical exam, just like we would do an exam answer. And, you know, I assess a lot more than just how the uterus moves and other nodules, because there's so much more to the pain associated with endometriosis in a lot of these patients, because it has all these downstream effects that we also want to assess and treat. If we only narrow ourselves and treat the endometriosis, we're not actually treating the patient, right? Patients aren't their disease, but they are kind of everything that's causing their pain. So we need to treat how the muscles are interacting with their pain, how the nerves are interacting with their pain, as well as the root cause, which is a lot of the time endometriosis. The humongous advantage we have here is the use of ultrasound diagnosis. And this has been an up-and-coming thing, which doesn't have a whole lot of availability or access for patients, which makes me really sad, because ideally, everybody would have access to a really advanced gynecologic ultrasound, which would be able to map their endometriosis, but it's just not realistic at this point in time. In Ontario, as far as I know, there's really only two groups that are performing these ultrasounds at a really high level in terms of mapping actually location, size of lesions, so deep endometriosis. And that's here at Care Imaging, which I perform these examinations myself in terms of the ultrasounds with some of the sonographers that we work with here, as well as at McMaster and SUGO, which is an ultrasound clinic in Hamilton. And we do the same thing, essentially, when we're looking at these things. And we can identify very accurately where the deep endometriosis lesions are. And the positive and negative predictive values, and, you know, we're getting to statistics here, which everybody's eyes are glossing over. But really, all this says is that if we see it, we can very accurately say that, yes, this is deep endometriosis. This is where it is. This is how big that nodule is. And this is all these things that are stuck to it or not stuck to it, which is really important information for us with regards to surgery and fertility. And if it's not there, we can very confidently say that deep endometriosis is not present. And those two sides of that coin are super, super important for that patient and really, really important for the consent process prior to surgery and the decision-making process with regards to fertility and fertility treatments, either in conjunction with surgery or without surgery, right? Mm-hmm. So surgery is not necessary for all these patients. And we also have medical treatments. And I think that really needs to be tailored for the patient. The superficial endometriosis lesions is an up-and-coming area, and we're getting really good at identifying superficial endometriosis when there's something what we call free fluid inside the pelvis. And this is something that's naturally there. It's not an abnormal thing, but it happens kind of dependent on where people are in their cycle a lot of the time. And usually there's a little bit of fluid that we can find in the area behind the uterus, which is the most common place for us to find superficial endometriosis. And we can actually see these lesions. Now, without that fluid, we don't have that window to be able to see them. We don't have the contrast to be able to see these lesions because they're so small, and they get lost where different organs are kind of rubbing up against each other because they get lost in kind of that interface. So that free fluid is really necessary for that diagnosis. And if we see those lesions on ultrasound, we can confidently say that they're there. But if we don't see them and there's no free fluid or there's limited free fluid in the pelvis, we can't like rule out the fact that there's superficial endometriosis. And there's a good portion of our population that has superficial endometriosis without deep endometriosis. It's important to remember, for me, I always have to remind myself, we're not just treating the deep endometriosis lesions that we can so readily see, but we also have to think about all these superficial lesions that are also going to be contributing. And we can't necessarily see those on all of our ultrasounds. And we definitely can't map them in the same way that we do the deep lesions, because even if there's free fluid, we may not have enough free fluid in the pelvis to see all of the lesions. That has been the absolutely most important thing for me in terms of diagnosis, because now we can accurately give patients a picture of what their endometriosis looks like beforehand. As I was saying, the ultrasound has been able to look at ovarian endometriosis for a long period of time in terms of identifying them. It's been pretty well documented over a long period of time, but the deep and superficial lesions are a huge advancement in what we have now. And I think it's really special when we talk to our patients, we're scanning them, we actually show them the screen, we're like, look, this is the lesion. And they're like, oh my God, like the validation is amazing. Mm-hmm. Somebody's like actually without having to go through a surgery, which has a huge amount of risk for a diagnosis, mm-hmm. We're able to be like, yes, this is your disease. We see your disease, right? And help you through this journey that you're on to try and treat your disease in the best way we can. And now we have a good idea of what picture we're working with. You know, we all look at the fallopian tubes, and that's super advantageous for us. When we see these really dilated fallopian tubes, we have a good reason why we, and a really good, you know, post-surgical effect when we remove that tube in terms of improving people's fertility, both if they have a normal tube on the other side and if they're going through IVF, but if they have a normal open tube on the other side, they can get pregnant naturally. That tube that's abnormal is actually preventing them from getting natural pregnancy as well.
That's right. It sounds like the conventional way to make this diagnosis of endometriosis, or I guess the one thing that I kind of refer to as like the gold standard, is still surgery, laparoscopy, and potentially getting a pathologic diagnosis, but that this may be potentially, is it fair to say, the way of the future? Or do you think that this is kind of here now and it's becoming increasingly popular?
I think it's the way of the now. It's just the uptake of it has been a lot slower than some of us wanted. So this has been around. This is not brand new. This is not like 2023. This has been around for a while. In Canada, there's been no access to this really until 2021 when they started performing these advanced scans in Hamilton. And that's been really advantageous for a huge population of endometriosis patients, as well as a lot of surgeons, right? So a lot of surgeons want these preoperative ultrasounds so that they know exactly what they're getting into. You know, when we look at the gold standard, quote unquote, of diagnosis with surgery, there's two issues that I have with it. One, the diagnostic laparoscopy is not like the riskiest surgery in the world, but it comes with significant surgical risk, anesthetic risk, as well as the surgical risk. You know, even entry for a laparoscopy has risk in terms of damaging organs and things like that. It's not a risk-free endeavor. So you are putting a patient at risk for a diagnosis. But the second thing is, a lot of the time, the information we get from a diagnostic laparoscopy, especially if people have really complex disease, is not as good as the information we get from the ultrasound. Because all of that deep endometriosis is hidden underneath of a uterus that's really stuck. We don't know if there's a lesion of deep endometriosis hiding in the wall of the rectum, which we can so easily see now with ultrasound. And Care Imaging has been so good to me because they provided me with like the Rolls Royce of ultrasound machines. And, you know, Roger Strunel is the director of Care Imaging, has bought this amazing probe that we use, which is a 3D transvaginal probe with extremely high frequency. So we can actually look at the two layers of muscle of the rectum and determine how deep this lesion in the rectum goes. Is it only in that outer layer of the muscle? And that changes the risk in terms of surgery, right? Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, 4 centimeters long? Is it, you know, 15 millimeters long? That has a huge impact. Does it go all the way through both those layers into the like lumen, which is like the inside where the poop is inside the rectum, that's going to have a big impact in terms of what we're going to do in surgery and how we're going to consent people and what we're going to talk about in terms of really tailoring the consent process and the surgical choices that the patient ultimately should get to make. That shouldn't be up to me when I'm in surgery being like, well, I think they probably want me to take that bowel lesion out, but we didn't know about it beforehand. I think that's totally unfair to a patient, right? If they know about it beforehand, we can talk about all of these risks beforehand. They can have a really good informed decision. I can have them see a colorectal surgeon beforehand who can come to the surgery with me, and we can do it in a planned way, which is so much more beneficial for the patient, the hospital, me, because it allows us to plan surgical time. We work really closely in the multidisciplinary team, both with the fertility group, but also with colorectal surgeons and the urologists here at the hospital. So it's been really good for us to be able to have that information before we go into surgery so the patients know exactly what to expect.
Can you briefly talk about the risk associated with surgery? And I know that you alluded to that a bit, but I think it would be great for our listeners to have an understanding of what is entailed in a laparoscopic surgery, both from the simple diagnosis point of view, which you are right, you know, an ultrasound is a much better way of doing that, and from the point of view of actually removing deep endometriosis.
So I think we're talking about two different surgeries. When we look at the two types of surgery, we're looking at a laparoscopic surgery for a diagnosis, which will usually incorporate putting two laparoscopic ports in, usually one in the belly button, one somewhere else on the abdomen, and taking a look around, taking pictures, and maybe taking a biopsy. So you may have the exact same number of holes in the abdomen for the same number of ports if they're taking biopsies. And biopsy is kind of like when we're talking about gold standard, it's the gold of gold standard, platinum standard, right? Like your pathologist says, under the microscope, this is all of the features of endometriosis. But interestingly, that is also not 100% accurate. Right? So they miss lesions because it all depends on where things get sliced. There's cautery artifacts sometimes, which destroys parts of the lesion. So they can't identify all the markers they need. So it's not perfect. So the diagnostic laparoscopy is that really just like seeing, maybe taking a biopsy or two. And then the treatment laparoscopy, which is what I endorse. Essentially, we talked about going in and treating your endometriosis in a broad categorical phase. There's two types. There's ablation surgery and excisional surgery. I really only perform excisional surgery because based off of kind of how the disease works, it makes a lot more sense to me that we actually remove the disease. Ablation surgery is essentially burning the deposits, and that can really be limited to superficial endometriosis. The biggest issue with that is, one, you don't know how deep those deposits go, so you don't know how much you've actually destroyed the endometriosis. And also, nobody wants to burn things when it's right on top of other structures they don't want to injure, right? We have a lot of structures inside the pelvis that are right underneath where the endometriosis loves to live, including the ureters, which are the tubes between the bladder and the kidneys, as well as big blood vessels and nerves inside the pelvis, fallopian tubes, ovaries, all these things that if we do excisional surgery, we can actually open that lining of the pelvis, separate all those structures we don't want to injure away from the lining and excise with a margin, much like cancer surgery, around. So even if there's microscopic disease that are around these visible lesions, we incorporate those in our excision. So we're really getting all of the disease, and our goal is complete excisional surgery. So removing every bit of endometriosis. And this comes with risks. Risks of surgery, or I always think of them in five. There's five risks with every surgery. Those risks, the details will change, but those risks are always going to be present in every surgery. There's damage to surrounding structures inside the pelvis. You're looking at the bowel, the bladder, the tubes between the bladder and the kidneys called the ureters, as we talked about before. Blood vessels, uterus, ovaries, fallopian tubes, and then the nerves inside the pelvis. In general, those are the things that we can damage. In the hands of a really skilled surgeon, those risks are extremely low. With more complex disease, those risks will be changed. And that's why this consent process and the complexity of disease prior to surgery is so important, because then we can get a much better idea of what that risk is. The second risk is infection, then bleeding, having a blood clot around the time of surgery, and the anesthetic risks, which is going to sleep, staying asleep, waking back up. All those risks are pretty well the same. The bleeding risk can be changed a little bit depending on the complexity of the disease. Infection risk can change a little bit, especially with bowel involvement. But in general, these are all pretty low risks, but we really do need to be able to have that good consent process beforehand. The surgery, in terms of what it looks like for the patient, they come in, it's a day surgery, they come into the operating room, they go off to sleep. We do the surgery through like tiny little incisions. Our incisions, a lot of the time, are all just 5 millimeters. Sometimes we have a 1 centimeter incision buried in the belly button, and then 2 5-millimeter incisions on one side of the abdomen and 1 5-millimeter incision on the other. And those are all the incisions we need to remove all of the endometriosis most of the time. In super complex disease, sometimes we have, we have to extend some of these incisions. Sometimes there's an incision in the back of the vagina if the actual lesions go from the abdomen all the way through the back of the vagina. And we have to separate that, open the back of the vagina, and then close it again. So there's that incision there. But in general, those are pretty uncommon circumstances. So people go home with these tiny little holes, and they have a really big surgery on the inside, but very small holes to show for it on the outside. And people tolerate the surgery well. You're going to be sore for a couple of weeks and totally back to normal, probably a month to 6 weeks. But people come in the morning, they go home in the evening. And people tolerate it really, really well. And a lot of the time, it actually improves their pain so much, they're so happy.
One more question. In your experience, how often does endometriosis come back after an excisional surgery?
The thought about recurrence is changing. The more modern evidence is talking less about recurrence and more about residual disease. So what we used to think was recurrent disease, probably disease that was left behind in a surgery before. There's microscopic disease that sometimes we can't see at the time, even with a really, really good look and an expert eye. But that's becoming less and less common with better excisional techniques. The biggest recurrence risk is in the ovaries, because as we're trying to maintain the best ovarian health, we're trying to cause the least amount of damage. And sometimes some of those cells of endometriosis are left inside the ovary. So recurrence inside the ovary is the highest, but recurrence outside of that, inside the pelvis, is much, much lower than was previously expected with good excisional surgery. Ablation surgery, obviously, the recurrence rate is going to be higher for all the reasons we talked about earlier. So choosing your surgeon is really, really important in this. Somebody who's well-trained, specialized, has specific training in endometriosis is probably going to get you a much better end result than people who don't.
So in regards to this mapping on ultrasound of the endometriosis and endomapping, how does it compare to, let's say, MRI, which I know a lot of patients are seeking, or they're on wait lists, rather, I should say, for MRIs?
So MRI is really helpful in terms of identifying some types of endometriosis. With regards to, they've done some, meta-analyses and some very complex statistics looking at how the MRI compares to the ultrasound in terms of diagnosis of different types of endometriosis. Pelvic endometriosis, I think right now, most people are, the access is better and the results are better in skilled hands. But that being said, you really do need that skilled operator. So it's so operator dependent that ultrasound is difficult to access and sometimes more difficult to access than MRI. But it doesn't mean that you don't need skilled hands to read the MRI either. So there's a lot of radiologists that don't do a lot of pelvic or endometriosis in terms of looking at things. And you're going to get a report that reflects that. And then we have some amazing radiologists who have this specific interest in MRI and endometriosis. And they're incredible at identifying all these lesions. So we get really, really good reports and results from that. The MRI machine, and there's all these fancy sequences they use to try and optimize the images they get as well. And that makes a huge difference in terms of being able to see these lesions. Inside the pelvis, I'd say, the jury's still out which one's going to win one way or the other. I'm partial to ultrasound because I can actually perform the ultrasound and get a really good idea of how things move, how things interact with each other in the pelvis. Outside of the pelvis, way more difficult, right? So MRI is definitely going to win, diaphragms, lung, other areas of the body. MRI is hugely important around like the nerve roots inside the pelvis and those rare patients. We see MRI is really important as well.
Can you tell our listeners about the issues with access to a specialized endometriosis surgeons in Ontario?
There's not that many.
And what are the waiting lists for?
They're horrible. My waiting list for surgery right now is about a year. We try and mitigate that as much as we can. I pick up extra OR days to try and minimize our wait times, but there's not a lot of us. And there's more and more people being trained, which is great and fantastic. We're an expensive resource for hospitals as well. So it's not that there's not necessarily the urge for people to be there, but you know, OR time is expensive for hospitals to provide. The surgeries take longer than basic, less complicated gynecologic surgeries. So as a result, they're more expensive for the hospitals and it takes skilled people to do it. So that's a pretty scarce resource as well. The wait times are pretty similar for most endometriosis specialists in Ontario. You're looking between 8 months to 2 years for surgery, and that's really horrible. Right.
Especially for a fertility patient.
Well, I think for a fertility patient or a pain patient, like a lot of these pain patients, they take so long to see us in the first place. And then they have to wait a whole another year. Right. Yes. It's horrible. We're condemning people to pain for an extra year because we can't afford to get them into the OR earlier. And I think it's an absolute shame. Endometriosis surgery is only going to worsen the issue in terms of waits for our patients. And it's brutal for fertility patients who sometimes the clock is not really in their favor, right? Sometimes they're coming to see us late in their journey and the time where they're going to be able to get better number of eggs, and that year can make a big difference.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we're definitely going to have you back for another episode because I feel like there's still so much left to talk about.
Okay, I do have one really important question. So I hear that you have known Dr. Weiss, Marta, for 8 years and you went to residency together. So you need to tell me some really embarrassing stories about her. I need to hear it.
Okay, so before he answers, I would like to remind him that I have embarrassing photos and videos. Okay, so choose your words carefully.
Marta, you act like you're the only person with embarrassing photos and videos of me. You should really check yourself. Just call my wife. She's got so many. Okay. Yeah. Marta was my senior. Like, and when I started residency, she was the glamorous one. And the funny thing is it's never changed, right? Like
She's still the glamorous one.
Yeah. That's coming from you, Mavis. Glamour treats both of you very well. But she was our senior resident at Toronto East General, which is now Michael Guerin Hospital. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, that's also where I met Dr. Brill, which is how I got introduced to Markham Stouffville Hospital. The connections are hilarious now. And Crystal Chan, who's the other guru of your group here at Markham Fertility, was at that time at Mount Sinai Fertility downtown and was one of my preceptors during residency as well. Now, Marta had this ring and it was enormous. Like the stone on this thing would block out the sun. And it was this beautiful, pink, shiny stone. And I remember looking at this thing being like, who is this woman? And how did she get somebody to buy her that enormous ring? And I was like, who bought that for you? And she's like, oh, I bought that for me. And I was like, okay, fair enough. We need Mike to
drop.
Need to make yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. The moral of the story is if you like it and you buy it for yourself. You
buy it for yourself. We don't need anybody to buy the stuff, Jenny, don't you know?
Very true. I do. All right. Still have that ring. I love it. Yeah.
I don't think I've seen that ring. You don't wear it anymore.
I don't wear it as often. Yeah. I got to pull it out. It's pretty. I'll bring it.
As a way to end this episode, Dr. Zen, is there anything you want our patients to know? Leave our patients with some words of advice or wisdom from your perspective.
I think that as a general whole, I think society needs to reevaluate how they approach fertility and pelvic pain. And we need to have a lot more grace when we talk with people and when we empathize with people. It makes a huge difference in people's lives when they're, first of all, taken seriously, when they are listened to, and when somebody actually acknowledges that what they're going through is really difficult, right? Fertility is really difficult. We know there's so much good evidence in terms of the toll fertility takes on people's mental health over a long period of time. And pelvic pain is the same. And when you put both those things together in the same patient, it's horrible, right? These people, they suffer. And it really hurts when I hear these stories of people who have just been underplayed their entire lives. And my mother was one of those people. My mother had stage 4 endo. When we're talking about stages, she has endometrium, was the size of grapefruits. She ended up having endometriosis surgery after I was born and was one of the fortunate ones who ended up having not really huge amounts of fertility issues until after me, but had horrible, horrible pain and was really the inciting factor for me when I was in residency and going into pelvic pain as a kind of a calling. Looking back and not really understanding what my mother went through when I was a kid and looking back and seeing all those memories and seeing them in a different light has completely changed how I approach my patients. And my mother suffered for so, so many years with pain, and she's the strongest person I've ever met in my entire life. And like, I'm going to cry when I talk about this. I remember when I was young and she was just after she did surgery, my dad was talking to me about, you know, got to take it easy. You know, your mom's really sick, and just not really understanding. And we had like conversations with my mom since then and since I've gone into this. And I think this is a population that has been so marginalized for such a long period of time that it's really important that people take them seriously. And you guys do such an amazing service. I want to thank you for what you guys do for your patients, because I think that you guys treat them with the empathy and the care that these women really deserve and these families deserve, right? And thanks, guys.
Thank you. No, tears. This is why I have tissue behind me over there, because we cry all the time. This job is so personal for all of us. We all have a story. I didn't know about your mom.
I hope my mom doesn't get upset that I'm sharing her story on a podcast, but I think she'll be okay.
I think if my children ever go on a podcast and say something that nice about me, I would be very proud.
Aww. Thank you, Jeff, so much for coming on here and talking with us and sharing your insights. It was really interesting and really fascinating. I definitely learned a lot as well. And honestly, I look forward to working with you for many, many more years.
We have to make endometriosis mapping a reality, okay? That's our mission.
That's on our checklist.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thanks. Thank you so much. The pleasure is all ours. Okay, take care.
Bye, guys.
And that's a wrap for today, Superhumans.
If you're looking to connect, get social with us. Follow us on YouTube and Instagram at My Fertility Podcast, or visit us online at MyConFertility.com. And don't forget, follow, subscribe, and share your favorite episode.
Thanks for listening to My Fertility Podcast and for being a vital part of our community. We know you've got this.
We're signing off until next Tuesday.
If you found this episode of My Fertility Podcast helpful, please take a moment to head over to the review section and leave us your thoughts. Your reviews and comments are incredibly valuable to us and help guide future episodes. We also welcome you to direct your questions to info@myfertilitypodcast.com.
My Fertility Podcast is produced by Rabbit Media, Inc. in conjunction with Dr. Garcia and Dr. Weiss. Music from Mixkit, Raising Me Higher by AJ Stellino. My Fertility Podcast is not intended to replace any type or variation thereof professional medical, health, or legal advice, nor should the content be taken as medical advice. Please contact your primary healthcare professional regarding any medical questions you may have. The information presented in this podcast is based on the knowledge and understanding of the host at the time of recording. Medical knowledge is constantly evolving, and new research may change the understanding of health-related topics. While we strive to provide accurate and up-to-date information, we do not guarantee the completeness, accuracy, or timeliness of the content. The views expressed in this podcast by guests are not those of the host or the management. This podcast is not intended to impose any type of discrimination. My Fertility Podcast and its management are not responsible for any losses, damages, or liabilities that may arise from the use of this podcast.